Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T&Cs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
On March 2nd, 1998, 19-year-old Suzanne Lyle finished her shift at a software store in Albany, New York, and boarded a bus back to her dorm at SUNY Albany. A friend later reported seeing her get off at her usual stop on campus, but Susie never made it back to her room. The following day, her bank card was used at an ATM miles away from her campus. Despite decades of investigation, no one has ever been charged, and Susie has never been found. More than 28 years later, investigators believe she was the victim of homicide, but what actually happened to Suzanne Lyle remains unknown. Hey everyone, welcome back to Detective Perspective. My name is Derek Levasseur. I'm a licensed private investigator and former police detective. Each week I'll be covering an unsolved case in story format. I'll then give you my perspective on the investigation and provide contact information for the individuals or organizations connected to the case so that if you have any tips, you can contact them directly and maybe you can help solve a case. So if you're someone who's interested in true crime, specifically unsolved cases, and you would like to hear my opinion on those investigations, please consider subscribing, whether you're watching on YouTube or listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use. All right, so if you're watching on YouTube, you're probably noticing that I'm wearing the same shirt that I wore last week, and that's because I've been here all day. This is the second episode I'm recording today after researching this one, and that's because I'm going on vacation with the family next week and I won't be here. But I always feel guilty if I take a week off and don't put a case out there. I know there's going to be some weeks where I have to do that. This is not one of them. I want to get a case out there. And this is an interesting case. It reminds me a lot of the Lauren Spira case out of Indiana. And now her case is a little different. I will say the circumstances don't exactly align. But you're still talking about a story where you have a college student who's out at night. And you would think there's a lot of students around, populated area, and yet in this small window of time, clearly something bad happened. The question is what? And we're going to try to answer that. We're going to go over all the evidence. We're going to talk about what I think. And then I want to hear your opinions. We got a lot to cover, so let's dive into this week's case. Suzanne Gloria Lyle, who went by Susie, was born on April 6, 1978. She grew up in Ballston Spa in upstate New York with her parents Doug and Mary and two siblings. Susie's sister Sandy was 9 years older than her, and her brother Steve was 12 years older. They were all very close, with Sandy and Steve acting as second parents because of the age gaps. Susie stood out in the family for being creative, shy, and friendly. She had a way of putting everyone around her at ease. Susie loved to sew, write poetry, and listen to Rush, but her biggest passion was computers. When she was around 10 years old, her dad bought her an old computer and brought it home. At the time, computers were rare to have at home, and they were slow with very few practical uses. But Susie loved it and became obsessed with learning everything she could. By the time she was 12 years old, she was taking the computer apart and rebuilding it. She was way ahead of her time. With Susie being so shy, her parents believed she liked getting lost in the computer. And when she learned how to communicate with people through online bulletin boards, which was before chat rooms, she started making friends. One person she met online while in high school was a guy named Richard, who was a year older and lived in New York. Richard ran a group for people interested in computers, and Doug took her to one of the group meetings where she got to meet Richard in person. They later started dating, and they would chat back and forth about their respective computers. And Richard even wired their network so they could access her computer remotely. It surprised no one that after graduating with honors from Ballston Spa High School, Susie decided to study computer science. In the fall of 1996, she enrolled as a freshman at SUNY Oneonta. But she soon realized that she knew more than many of the teachers who were just starting to learn about computers themselves. So after one full year, Susie decided to transfer to SUNY Albany, hoping she could take more advanced classes. Susie's parents also believed she wanted to attend college in Albany because that's where Richard was living. So in the fall of 1997, Susie transferred to begin her sophomore year. She and Richard continued dating. She also worked part-time at Babbage's Software, a computer software store at Crossgates Mall. By late February of 1998, 19-year-old Susie was preparing for spring midterms. She had one midterm in particular that was a huge deal, and she spent a lot of time studying for it. She had straight A's and wanted to maintain them. On the night of March 1st, Susie called her mother to wish her a happy birthday. She apologized for not coming home to celebrate that night, but she wanted to focus on her midterms. Other than regular stress about school, she seemed normal. On March 2nd, Susie went to classes. She took that midterm that she'd been studying really hard for. And then at 4 p.m., she took the Capital District Transit Authority, or CDTA, bus to work. This was normal for Susie, who did not have a driver's license. Susie got off work around 9 p.m., and she would normally call Richard once she arrived back at her dorm room, but he never heard from her that night. He kept trying to call, but she never answered. On the morning of March 3rd, Richard called the Lyle home and said that Susie had not come back to her room the night before. He said she never called him and was not answering her phone. Susie's father, Doug, quickly jumped in his car and raced to the university. When he got to her dorm room, he found that it did not appear to be disturbed. Her glasses were there, her hair dryer was sitting on the bed, nothing appeared to be out of place. Doug then went to campus police and reported Susie missing, but they said students routinely disappeared for short periods of time and that there was nothing to worry about. He told campus police that this was not normal for Susie, so they sent an officer to see if she had shown up for class that day, and she had not. Despite this new information, campus police still believed that Susie would turn up and simply needed some time away. So, Doug stayed on campus all day, hoping to find her. Meanwhile, Mary was at home calling friends and family, but no one had seen Susie. When the mail arrived, she rushed to check it, and inside was a birthday card Susie had mailed to her the day before. It contained a normal message, something along the lines of, quote, "I love you, I'll see you soon." At approximately 4 p.m., Mary had the idea to call Susie's bank to see if there was any activity on her account, which contained approximately $120. Surprisingly, the bank told her that Susie's card had just been used minutes earlier at an ATM to withdraw $20. They also stated that the correct PIN had been entered on the first attempt. However, that was all the bank employee could tell her, and she would have to wait until the following morning to learn which ATM had been used. With that information, Mary and Doug hoped Susie was simply taking some time away and would eventually come back. They were still very concerned, but it gave them a small reason to believe that she was okay. When the sun started to set and Susie still had not returned to campus, Doug headed home. He and Mary stayed up all night waiting for word. Meanwhile, campus police worked to put together a timeline of Susie's last known movements on March 2nd. They learned that Susie arrived at work shortly after 4 p.m., and her boss said she seemed completely normal and nothing out of the ordinary happened during her shift. Susie left work at approximately 9:20 p.m. and boarded a bus near the mall. The bus driver recalled seeing her get on at the shop because he recognized her from taking the route on numerous occasions after work. The driver could not say for certain where she got off, however, he knew she was not on the bus when he reached his final stop downtown. Investigators continued interviewing people, and eventually they learned that one of Susie's friends actually saw her get off the bus at approximately 9:40, 9:45 p.m. at the Collins Circle stop on campus. The friend did not speak with Susie, but was adamant that she saw her. And that did make sense because Collins Circle was the stop that Susie always used after work. It was only about 900 to 950 feet or approximately a 3 to 5 minute walk from her dorm in Colonial Quad. The only thing I'll say here, and I don't know what was used to verify, maybe they were able to determine what she was wearing at work that day and what this person saw her wearing at the bus stop to confirm it was the actual day. But my only fear, my only concern here would be, was this person remembering seeing her on a different day? Now, depending on when they spoke to this person, that becomes less likely. I mean, if they talked to this person the day after Susie disappeared, okay, fine. But if it was a week or two later, it becomes a little bit more gray. So I would want to know more specifics to feel confident, but based on some of the other information we're going to talk about later in this episode, it is very likely that this is the day in question. Investigators spoke with Susie's suitemates and learned that she never returned that night. They also checked her dorm access card records and confirmed that she never swiped into the building. Based on all this information, investigators believed that Susie never made it back to her dorm after getting off the bus, leaving a window of only approximately 5 to 10 minutes for something to have happened to her. And this is what I was talking about earlier when I said this case reminded me of Lauren Spear. There's a moment where you think that Lauren has a short walk back to her place, and yet she just disappears. She never makes it. And here's a similar circumstance where you have 900 to 950 feet, 3 to 5 minutes. And in that small window, Susie just disappears. Unexplainable, and yet it happened. And by morning, Susie still had not been heard from, and she did not show up for her classes. So Mary called the bank back and learned that the ATM used on March 3rd was located at Stewart's shop at the corner of Central Avenue and Manning Boulevard in Albany, approximately 2.5 to 3 miles from campus. And obviously this information is critical, right? This could be the smoking gun in the case. But there were also two other charges that would come into question. And we're going to talk about it right after the break. Between diets, workouts, and endless advice, it's hard to know what actually works for weight loss and what's worth your time. That's why Hers offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications that now includes the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, you can lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps regulate your appetite, helps you eat less, and helps you keep the weight off. And the process is simple. Everything happens 100% online. You connect with a licensed provider who determines if treatment is right for you, and if prescribed, medications delivered right to your door. No insurance necessary. Plus, you also get access to ongoing support, care team messaging, and lifestyle tools designed to help you build habits that actually last. So if you're ready to reach your goals, visit forhers.com/detective to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's FORHERS.com/detective. Once again, that's forhers.com/detective. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is a registered trademark by Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com. All right, so we're back from break, and I was talking about the charge on March 3rd that Mary had called the bank to inquire about to get those details. And while she was on the phone, the bank also told her that on March 2nd, the day Susie disappeared, her card had been used at two separate ATMs to withdraw $20 each. The first transaction occurred at an ATM across the street from where she caught the bus on campus to go to work at the mall. She then withdrew another $20 from an ATM at the mall. And Mary knew that Susie always withdrew a single $20 bill when she would use an ATM, but it was unusual for her to make two withdrawals back to back and to use an ATM that was not affiliated with her bank. Mary later explained to WAMC that Susie was very frugal and would only use one of her bank's ATMs to avoid paying a fee. I'm not going to push back on Mary. She knows more about her daughter than I ever will. The only thing I'll say is I was like that as well when I was doing a lot of withdrawals from the ATM. I always tried to use my bank ATMs. But there were a few occasions where I would take out money and then realize that I didn't take out enough. And by the time I realized it, I was in an area where my bank ATMs weren't located. So I had no choice but to reluctantly use an ATM nearby to get out the remaining money that I needed. So on one hand, I look at this information and I say, it's probably just a rare circumstance that doesn't normally happen, but has nothing to do with what we're looking into. On the other hand, you have to treat everything as a potential piece of evidence, as a potential clue. Because if you're sitting there going, I'm not going to look into it. She probably just needed more money. We know she was fine after that. It's not important to what we're doing. You could be missing a critical part of the case. Maybe the charges themselves aren't important, but what you find at those locations could be. Maybe you get surveillance footage, and while you're reviewing it, you see a familiar character on both videos or both photos. Maybe you see someone that you recognize that was familiar with Susie. There's a lot of things that could happen. So yes, on the surface, it's a nothing burger, but when you start to dive into it, maybe there's something in the background that can actually help you solve the case. So if you're not doing your due diligence and you're not following up on every lead, regardless of what you think it represents, as an investigator, you're not doing your job. And so once Mary had all this information, not only from March 3rd, but also March 2nd, she called the campus police and relayed this information. And at that point, they filled her in on the timeline that they were able to put together. They also acknowledged that now at this part in the investigation, they were concerned about Susie. So they contacted the New York State Police, who launched their own investigation as well. Authorities and Susie's loved ones searched more than 400 acres, including the campus, Crossgates Mall, and local bike paths. There was no sign of her anywhere. At the same time the searches were underway, investigators were also working to determine who had made the withdrawal at Stewart's on March 3rd. Now here's the bad part, and I'm sure none of you are going to be surprised by this. Unfortunately, the store surveillance camera was up and running, but it did not cover the area in front of the ATM. It only captured the register area, so there was no footage of the person who used the machine. Investigators also spoke with the store clerk, who did not recognize Susie. So they continued reviewing surveillance footage and receipts and eventually determined that one unidentified customer had used the ATM at approximately the same time Susie's card was used. The customer was a man wearing a hat with a Nike Swoosh logo on it. Investigators, unfortunately, didn't know who this guy was, so they released a sketch of this person, who became known as Nike Man, and they asked the public for help identifying him. And luckily, with the public's help, eventually they did locate Nike Man, and they were able to question him. Investigators later told CBS that, quote, "The indication is that he was not involved, although they could not definitely rule him out." And this statement right here is perplexing to me without having all the details, because if this was the man who used the ATM, he knew Susie's PIN. How did he know her PIN? He can't come out and say, "Oh, I found the debit card on the ground and, you know, I just saw it and I wanted to try to see if there was money on it." Well, yeah, then you would use it as like a credit card, not a debit card. You wouldn't have access to the PIN. Whoever used this card clearly did. So reading between the lines on this one, I think they got the wrong guy. I think they tried to use reasonable deduction to identify the person at the ATM. But if this was the person, how are you not looking deeper into him? How can you come out and say that he wasn't involved? There's some major questions there. How did you get her card? And how did you know her PIN? So the only reasonable conclusion I can come to where they're coming out publicly and saying he was not involved, that's their indirect way of saying, without saying it, we got the wrong guy. Thanks for the help finding him, but this isn't the person we're looking for. Unfortunate, but that's my interpretation of it. And I hope that I'm wrong. Unfortunately, I don't think I am. I will say that that ATM transaction, the one on March 3rd, was the last time Susie's bank account was accessed, and it marked the final confirmed entry in her timeline. Now, just some additional information, because I want to make sure I'm answering your questions as I'm trying to anticipate what you're going to ask. They did fingerprint the ATM, but unfortunately, they didn't find anything conclusive. They also searched Susie's computer for evidence, and there was nothing out of the ordinary there either. And I bring that up because you think about the potential that maybe she was meeting up with someone, and maybe she was talking to someone in one of these online chat rooms or bulletin boards, and this would have given us an indication of her planning to meet up with someone when she got off the bus. But nothing like that, and unfortunately, nothing at the ATM that could have been dusted and matched to anyone that we would want to question. And so, based on everything they had learned up to that point, detectives feared that Susie had been met with foul play after getting off the bus. Her parents feared the same and believed she had been abducted. As a result, investigators began treating the case as a homicide investigation, though everyone held on to the hope that Susie would be found alive. So investigators asked Richard where he was at the time Susie got off the bus, and Richard claimed that he had been at home with his parents playing chess online with a friend. Investigators spoke with the friend, who supported his story and even went on to say that he knew all of Richard's moves and could tell it was him playing. So on the surface, Richard appeared to have an alibi. However, according to CBS, Richard and his family stopped cooperating with authorities shortly after his initial interview. He refused to take a polygraph and would not speak with investigators again without an attorney present. Richard also said some things during an interview that stood out to Susie's parents. He told investigators that he and Susie were engaged, something no one else appeared to know, including Susie's family, who was very close to her. Susie's parents also told investigators that the relationship was not always healthy. Mary said that Richard could become possessive and jealous, and she said there were numerous times where Susie tried to break up with him, but he would become emotional and she would ultimately stay. And because of this, the Lyles have questioned whether Richard could have been involved, and others have as well. Despite that, investigators have never publicly commented on Richard, and he has never been named a person of interest. So here's my two cents on Richard, and we'll talk about him again in the perspective because obviously he has to be someone we consider, right? Yeah, he has an alibi with the chess game, but that's not that concrete. Did anybody have physical eyes on him? That's what I want to know. And based on what I've read and what I've researched, that doesn't appear to be the case. Yes, the family was home, but did they actually see him? That's what I want to know. But even with that being said, here's my thoughts on this. And we've talked about this numerous times, and my stance on it's not going to change. I would like to see the people closest to the victim always participate in the investigation. And I would like to believe that they would always be treated with respect. And there's never going to be a time where someone gets charged with a crime they didn't commit. But we know that's not true. There are plenty of people in prison right now for crimes that they're not responsible for. That's the unfortunate reality. It's my worst nightmare. And I hope that I have no cases of mine ever come out to be that way. Knock on wood, so far so good. So is it possible that Richard had absolutely nothing to do with what happened to Susie, and yet during his initial interview, he felt like that's what they were implying? Hey man, you're the boyfriend, you were close by, you would have known that she was getting off the bus, you knew her routine, things weren't always great between you. Did you get mad at her? Were you following her? Did you think that she was seeing someone else? Did you guys have any arguments as of late? And he might have said with his parents, whoa, I'm not saying anything else because these guys are looking in the wrong direction. And if I say the wrong thing, they're going to arrest me. That's happened before. And so I wanted to make sure that I mentioned here, he did speak with law enforcement, but only with an attorney present. And I have zero issues with that. So you can look at it whatever way you want. I would love to hear your opinions on Richard and this approach, but I think by now you guys know where I stand on this. Hey, guess who the next sponsor is? If you're a regular on this show, then you know I talk a lot about Smalls. They make fresh, human-grade food for cats. It's made from the same stuff you or I would eat, but formulated specifically to help cats thrive. And we're going to play your favorite game. You know what I'm talking about? It's false or fact. So, false or fact, the ingredients in most grocery store cat food is watered down and corn. That's a fact. Most cat food is filled with water and fillers. That's it. Next one, false or fact. Some cat food brands use the same meat grade you'd find in a hot dog. Again, unfortunately, a fact. 4D meat, which is from dead, dying, diseased, or disabled animals, is technically legal in pet food. Absolutely disgusting. Most of us treat our pets like our kids, and so why would you feed them that? You wouldn't feed it to your kids, right? So why would you feed it to your cat? False or fact, a bag of cat food labeled natural has zero legal definition behind it. Again, scary, but that's a fact. The word natural is largely unregulated in the pet food industry. Last one, false or fact, some cat food contains so much carbohydrate filler that it's actually closer to a granola bar than it is a prey animal. Again, you guessed it, it's a fact. Dry kibble can be 30 to 50% carbs, despite cats having almost no dietary need for them. Listen, high-quality food is an investment in your cat's health. Vet bills can rack up into the thousands of dollars, but the good thing is Smalls may help offset that by feeding them better food. And that's because Smalls' fresh, gently cooked food is made without preservatives. A balanced diet leads to less shedding, fewer hairballs, and more silky shine. Smalls cat food leads to high protein and improved hydration. That equals stronger bones and toned muscles. And for anybody who doesn't know, cats use protein as their main source of energy. More protein means more fuel and sustained energy. And by the way, it's not just me saying this. Forbes ranked Smalls cat food the best overall cat food as well. So stop serving your little carnivore a bowl of processed shortcuts for a limited time. Because you are a Detective Perspective listener or viewer, you can get 60% off your first order plus free shipping and free treats for life when you head to smalls.com/detective. One last time, that's 60% off your first order plus free shipping and free treats for life when you head to smalls.com/detective. Today's episode is brought to you by Square, the business toolkit that helps you sell, manage, and grow without the chaos. Whether you're just getting started or already running something great, Square gives you the tools to take payments, track sales, manage your team, and keep everything organized all in one place. And right now, listeners can save up to $200 off Square hardware when you sign up at square.com/go/detective. That's SQUARE.com/go/detective. Visit Square to get started because the right tools make all the difference. And listen, I'm not just promoting Square. I actually use it. I've talked about it before. I got my CrimeCon t-shirt on right now. We sold all of our merch out there and I was able to track inventory, change pricing, see what sizes were going quickly, what colors may not have been selling as well. And then when I got home, I got to look at all the data. I was able to separate it by business because I had both Criminal Coffee and Crime Weekly. I was able to see what did better, what sizes I should order more of next year, and what designs you guys really liked. So I love Square. I'll always use it, and I think you guys will get a lot out of it as well. So take payments, manage inventory, schedule your team, and track reports all in one connected platform. No switching tabs, no separate logons, just one place for your business to live. Square lets you start selling in person or online from your counter, your phone, your website, or even through delivery platforms. Take tap, chip, swipe, Apple Pay, invoices all through one system. Square helps you run your business with confidence, clarity, and less chaos. And now it's easier than ever to get started. And why wait? Right now you can get up to $200 off Square hardware at square.com/go/detective. Again, that's SQUARE.com/go/detective. Run your business smarter with Square. Get started today. So as the investigation continued, investigators kept speaking with Susie's friends and family to learn more about her life. One of Susie's co-workers said that she had mentioned being stalked by an unidentified man before March of 1998, though she did not appear to be very concerned about this person. Further information about this potential lead is pretty much non-existent, and it's rarely mentioned in any of the reports about Susie's case. So I don't know what's going on there. That would be something that I would want to look into. That would be a thread I would definitely pull on. And maybe it was and it just wasn't written up, or maybe this person was identified and it turned out to be not connected. But I would like to see some documentation to support that, just so I could potentially rule it out as I'm sitting here discussing it with you guys. And besides this potential stalker, there were very few leads until approximately 2 months into the investigation. That's when on one evening in May, two students walking through the visitor parking lot adjacent to Collins Circle found a Babbage's software ID card belonging to Susie. Investigators were notified and took the card in as evidence. It was examined and processed for fingerprints and DNA, but the results were inconclusive. To this day, investigators do not know when the card ended up there. They don't know whether it was there before Susie disappeared, or whether she dropped it on the night she vanished, or if it was put there after. Detectives later told Investigative Discovery that they have wondered whether Susie walked from the bus stop to the parking lot to meet someone, or whether she may have been lured there. I'll be honest with you, that's my thought on this. I believe that unfortunately during the initial search, the badge was missed. I think it's too much of a coincidence that this badge was found right across the street from where Susie was last seen. We have to believe that whatever happened to Susie, whoever met her at that moment, whoever encountered her, it was right there. And so to believe that her badge would be found across the street, it's not a stretch. I am surprised that it took this long to find the badge. You have to think that investigators went back to the area where the victim was last seen. And you would think that they would be checking trash cans and under stairs and in alleys and anywhere in that area where they might see something that could indicate at minimum the direction their victim went. How do you miss the victim's badge that is probably within eyesight of where they were last seen? I will give them the benefit of the doubt here. It seems like they really worked this case hard and it was a lot of people involved. There is a possibility that when whatever happened to Susie happened, her badge was thrown on the ground and it went under a tarp or in an area of a drain or under a tire. And it wasn't until some weather, some wind blew it out that it was exposed and somebody saw it as they were walking through the area. Crazier things have happened. I really hope that's the case, because if this was in plain sight and there's no chance that it blew to this location, well, you have to question the entire investigation. If you can't find a victim's badge that's within 100 feet of where they were last located, that's a major problem and I have much bigger concerns. So let's just hope it was an act of God, some type of weather that prevented this badge from being found earlier and allowed it to be located later. Around 6 months into the investigation, investigators were running out of leads, so they began looking for cases with similar circumstances in the area. And this is a great approach. Not everybody does this, and they should be, because sometimes you can identify a pattern, and if there are potential suspects in that case, you can cross-reference if they were in the area during your victim's case. Sounds simple, but not everybody does it. Not everyone takes the time to go this deep because, candidly, it's a lot of work. That's what you're getting paid to do. So during that process, they learned about another SUNY Albany student, 22-year-old Karen Wilson, who had disappeared 13 years before Susie. Karen was last seen leaving a tanning salon on Central Avenue in Albany at approximately 7:20 p.m. on March 27, 1985. Three credible witnesses later reported seeing someone matching her description walking down Fuller Road after dark. One of those witnesses said that they saw a young man approach Karen as she neared the intersection of Fuller Road and Washington Avenue, and she was never seen again. Investigators working on Susie's case spent months exploring any possible connection between Susie and Karen, but unfortunately they were unable to find one. And to this day, Karen's disappearance remains unsolved as well, and that may be something I have to cover down the road. And when it came to looking at similar cases, detectives would later look at a man named John Regan after he attempted to kidnap a high school student in Saratoga Springs. Saratoga Springs is approximately 10 miles from Ballston Spa, where Susie grew up, and about 40 miles from Albany. The student was able to escape, and John was arrested, but because of the proximity to where Susie disappeared, investigators in Saratoga Springs contacted the New York State Police to make them aware of the case. Investigators from both agencies worked to put together a timeline of John's movements. They also attempted to question him about Susie's disappearance, but shocker, he did not cooperate. In the end, investigators were unable to find a connection between John and Susie. However, they did not rule him out. As the months continued to pass, there were no major developments in Susie's case. The Lyles did everything they could to help move the investigation forward. They also began helping other families, which eventually led to the creation of the Center for Hope, a nonprofit that provides resources to families of missing persons. Absolutely incredible. I talk about these stories all the time where parents go through these unthinkable tragedies, and yet not only are they able to move forward, but they're able to take their experiences to help others. Absolutely incredible. The Lyles also pushed for legislative changes, helping pass multiple laws. But one of the laws that I thought was the most critical was Suzanne's Law. This prevents law enforcement agencies from imposing a waiting period before accepting missing persons reports for young adults between the ages of 18 and 21. How many cases have I talked about that fit this criteria where law enforcement decides, we're going to wait. I'm sure they're fine. Here again, you have real families affected by real tragedy, fighting for people they don't even know, fighting for the next person that has to experience this horrific event, hoping that they get something different than what they experienced. They also helped pass the Suzanne Lyles Campus Security Act, which was signed into federal law and requires colleges to create written safety plans in partnership with local law enforcement. And I have to say that the Lyles, they've accomplished much more than what I just highlighted. They are truly remarkable people who have made a lasting difference, all in Susie's name. Sadly, Doug passed away on August 26, 2015, at the age of 73, never knowing what happened to his daughter. Mary continued pushing forward, advocating for Susie, working on her case, and helping other families along the way. In 2018, 20 years had passed since Susie disappeared. The lead investigator on the case told CBS 6 Albany that the investigation had gone cold due to the lack of evidence. The investigator explained, quote, "We need someone to come forward." Fast forward to April of 2026, 28 years after Susie disappeared, investigators came out and said they are still investigating her case as a homicide, but have no reason to believe she's alive. They continue to believe that someone knows what happened. 83-year-old Mary also spoke with the media, begging anyone with information to contact detectives. She said, quote, "I don't know how many days I have left. I need someone to come forward." It's absolutely heartbreaking to hear that, to know that this woman has come to the later stages of her life and all she can think about is leaving this world without knowing what happened to Susie. No one should be in that position. And unfortunately, this is the last major update we have in this case. Suzanne Lyle remains missing, and her mother and her siblings are still desperately searching for answers. All right, so let's dive into this perspective, and let's start with what we know. It's believed that she was seen getting off the bus between 9:40 and 9:45 on March 2nd. We know that it's a 3 to 5 minute walk to her room. She never made it. So whatever happened to her happened right there. The question is, did she get lured somewhere? Was she attacked from behind? Was she meeting someone? Or was someone there waiting for her? And you may hear that and think, oh, Derek's suggesting it's someone she knew. And I am. But I'm also suggesting that it could be someone who had seen her in the past, and yet she had never seen them. It could have been someone who had seen Susie get off at that bus stop numerous times at the same time, and most of those occasions she was alone. And so this person could have been watching her for days, for weeks, who knows how long, just waiting for an opportunity to take advantage of the situation. And unfortunately, March 2nd was the night they chose. So I don't want you to think I'm going one direction or the other, but when you take this information and couple it with the fact that whoever had her card the next day knew her PIN number, it definitely makes you wonder. And so what are we talking about as far as potential theories? I'll start with the things that I got to mention, but I don't necessarily believe that's what happened. The first one being that Susie left under her own free will. Things were going wrong in her life that we were unaware of, that nobody knew about, and she decided on this particular night she was going to run off. She was going to use her card to take $20 out, which wouldn't have gotten her far. And between that $20 and the $40 she had taken out the day before, she was going to run off, never use her card again, and 28 years later, never contact her family, even after watching from a distance everything that her family had been doing on her behalf. Not buying it. Not based on the person that I've read about. That's not Susie. That's not what she would do. I am confident in saying that's not what happened here. The next thing we have to talk about is Richard. And I already talked about him in the episode, but I'll mention him again here. I know that Susie's family has some suspicions about him based on the turbulent relationship at points. I don't have anything to suggest that he was involved. It seems like things were going well between them. There's a potential that they were engaged and they hadn't even told anybody yet. Yeah, there may have been some bumps in the road. I think we all have them. I don't think anybody out there who's in a relationship has this perfect thing where they've never had issues amongst them. It's just, it's natural. It's the way it is. And these guys are young and jealousy is a part of it. Let's just call it what it is. It doesn't appear that it rose to an unhealthy level. And yeah, people do try to break up and then they get back together. So for me as a father, my daughters are still young. I don't see any major red flags here. And the fact that he decided not to cooperate with law enforcement without an attorney, As I mentioned in the episode, I don't have a problem with that. Add on to that that you have an impartial witness saying that he was playing chess with him, and I don't know how you would fake that, but this person seems to believe that it was in fact Richard that he was playing the game with, and so I have no reason to dispute that. So in my opinion, although you can't take him off the list, I don't think Richard's your guy, which then leads us to the potential that this was a person who knew Suzanne or at least knew her routine and was waiting for her at the bus stop and she didn't know it. This could have been a friend, a fellow student, or as I mentioned a couple minutes ago, it could have been a resident living in the area who knew that there was a lot of young students in that area and knew it was dark and it was late at night and maybe nobody was around. And they had watched Susan get off the bus on numerous occasions. And this was something that they had thought about for a while. And this may have been pre-planned where they had things lined up so that they could attack her and get her off the street as soon as possible without anybody seeing or hearing her. And if that's the case, they could have placed her into a vehicle or inside an apartment. And unfortunately, we have to assume that whatever happened from that point on was not good. And more than likely, Suzanne's life was taken. And we do have some evidence that may suggest that there was a sign of struggle, her badge being one of those things. You have the badge in very close proximity to where she was last seen. To me, that's a clear indication that something went down where her badge was knocked off of her, right? It more than likely wasn't in her hand. So whatever happened, it came off of her clothing or off of her bag during more than likely a brief struggle. And this crime, some may say it could have been a robbery gone wrong. I don't believe that's the case. You have a young girl here, 19 years old, and more than likely the crime was sexual in nature. That's just the reality of it. And I'm sure that Susie's family has come to that conclusion as well. I hope that's not the case for everyone involved, but we're here to find out what actually happened. And I don't bring this up to make people feel worse about this case than you probably already do. I bring it up because it could help solve the case. Hopefully there's a list of everyone who was living in the area at that time. And I would imagine that they were vetted then, but if they weren't, you need to do so. You also need to look at the last 28 years. Were they ever involved in a crime that was sexual in nature? If they were, you need to go speak with them again because there could be a correlation there. And we know that the person was in that area at that time. Suzanne's badge being so close in proximity tells us that. Could it be a red herring? Could it be the offender going back and leaving this piece of evidence there to throw us off? Of course, I acknowledge that. I don't think it's the case. I think investigators missed it initially. I think the attack happened right there, and either the person lived in a location nearby or they had a car waiting right in that lot. And as soon as they grabbed Suzanne, they pulled her into the car, and that was it. And more than likely, she was kept alive for at least a short period of time, and that's how they were able to obtain the PIN number. They probably said, hey, listen, give me your PIN number. I just want the money and then I'm going to let you go. I will acknowledge that it's a little off to me because if the crime was sexual in nature, why would you run the risk of using her debit card and being exposed? People are going to ask questions if you're using a girl's debit card with her PIN and she's not there. So I'll be honest with you. I don't have an answer to that one. Maybe it's something simple that I'm not thinking of. And by all means, if something's running by your head as you're listening or watching this, please enlighten me. Let me know. How would you explain someone committing a crime, whether it was sexual in nature or even a robbery gone wrong? Once you take the victim, why would you risk using the card the next day with the PIN? Huge risk. The only thing that I could deduce was that the card was also dropped with the badge. But then I can't answer the question, how did this random person who picked up the debit card get the PIN? I can't explain it, but I'm no genius. Maybe someone out there can help me. But overall, a lot of what I'm saying right now requires the law enforcement agency to go back and start from the beginning. They can't just wait for new leads. They may not come. They have to go back and treat this case as if it happened yesterday. New investigators treating this case like it's day one. I talk about the Long Island serial killer all the time. It wasn't a new lead. It was something that was in the reports all along. Have someone sit down, start on page one, and go through the whole thing. Better yet, have multiple people do it, because I guarantee you, based on their own personal and professional experiences, they're all going to identify different things of importance. You cross-reference, you dial it in, and maybe you get something that helps you solve this case. In addition to that, We also have Suzanne's badge, and I know it was analyzed for fingerprints and DNA, but as I have said in many cases, I said it in last week's case with Will, DNA has come a long way, and with the samples we had back in 1998, 1999, we couldn't get much. But now those same samples are being re-examined, and they're able to solve a case that appeared to be unsolvable 20, 30 years ago. So if you have the funds, resubmit the card and see if with the new science and technology, there's something you can do. And if investigators are watching this episode or listening to it and they're saying, yeah, we would love to do that, but because it's a cold case, we don't necessarily have the funds for it, reach out to me. I got you covered. No questions asked. Just tell me this case. I'll know it and I'll send you the check. And finally, it comes down to you guys. There may have been someone who lived in that area at the time and saw something that stood out to them, but they didn't mention it to law enforcement. Maybe it was a vehicle. Maybe it was a suspicious person. Or maybe it was a behavior by a person that's in your life that was completely out of character shortly after Suzanne disappeared. All of these things need to be reported to law enforcement. So just to recap, 19-year-old Suzanne Lau was last seen at approximately 9:40 to 9:45 p.m., on March 2nd, 1998, after getting off the bus at the Collins Circle stop at the SUNY Albany campus in Albany, New York. Investigators believe that Susie never made it back to her dorm room. Her bank card was used the following day at an ATM in Albany, but she has never been seen or heard from again. More than 28 years later, investigators are still treating Susie's disappearance as a homicide. No arrests have been made, and what happened to Susie remains unknown. If you have any information in Susie's case, please call the New York State Police at 1-800-920-4150. My final words, as always, go out to the friends and family of Suzanne, specifically Steve, Sandy, and Mary. There's not much I can say here. Mary, what you and Doug have done, not only for Suzanne's case, but for everyone who's affected by cases involving missing persons, there's nothing that we can do to repay you, but we can do something to try to give you some peace. And that's to find out not only what happened to Suzanne, but identify the person responsible. You have said you don't know how much longer you have. I hope it's a long time, but regardless of how long it is, I would love for us to be able to give you what it appears you want most, which is to know what happened to your daughter? No parent should have to leave this world with that type of question. And I do want to say this, and this may not be everyone's cup of tea. I don't know if Mary's a religious person, but I believe that there is something after this. And whether it's this life or the next, you will be reunited with Suzanne. That's just my thing. But while we're all still here on this earth, we have to do everything in our power to get answers from Mary and her family. With what she's done, not only for the missing, but also for any future families who have to unfortunately go through a situation like this, to make sure that they don't experience what I've talked about so many times on this show. This is the least we can do for her. And I really hope I get the opportunity to let all of you know that we got the person responsible and Mary finally knows what happened to Suzanne. Until that day comes, please, everyone stay safe out there, and I'll see you soon.
It's Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games as all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21+.